Okay, I'm Mark Axon. I'm the chairman of the New York State Libertarian Party. Thank you all for coming tonight. This is the regular meeting of the Manhattan Libertarian Party. We meet here on the second Monday of every month. Tonight, we're going to talk about the internet. And I understand that there's this whole concept called net neutrality. I haven't got a clue what it means, but I'm sure we're going to find out. And moreover, there's this big issue as to the degree of how much regulation or no regulation would be appropriate. So tonight, we're very fortunate to have David Solomonoff from the Internet Society of New York with us. And David's going to speak for a little while and then open it up to questions. So please give David a hearty warm up.
Yes. Right. That's right. Okay, yes. I'm David Solomonoff. I'm the president of the Internet Society of New York, which is a chapter of the Global Internet Society, which has headquarters in Reston, Virginia, and Geneva, Switzerland, and 90 chapters all over the world. The Internet Society was originally formed back in the 90s to help sponsor something called the Internet Engineering Task Force, which is actually probably almost the ideal of a libertarian group. It's basically an open group of people who are interested in developing the technical side of the internet, and it's a meritocracy. Anybody who is knowledgeable about computer networks and has an opinion can get involved and make suggestions. Those suggestions are subject to a peer review, and basically, if it's a good idea, it may be implemented. Then that's how that works. So it's radically different from the types of bureaucratic governmental structures that we have, in regulating many other things. I wanted to thank Alton, of course, for inviting me here. And I'm hoping that the Internet Society of New York are not political organizations, but we share some ideals with the Libertarian Party, and I'm hoping that we can develop a synergistic relationship here. The Libertarian Party believes in the rights of individuals for life, freedom of speech and action, and the right to property. The Internet Society develops technical standards, it does education, outreach, and advocacy for the principles of an open internet, which is available for everyone to use, where the inner workings and structures of the and the technology are publicly available, and people can know how they work and take a creative part in continuing to develop them. And most importantly, we do believe in the right of free expression in cyberspace on the internet, without censorship, and with the right of individuals to use encryption technology to have private communication if they wish. We also believe, work, as I say, very much for the continuing development of the internet in a public, open way, so that as many people as possible can take part in the development, the technical development and the social development, and again, so that the inner workings are a matter of public record, and future technical developments are also a public process. On my description of the thing of my talk here, I said that I believe the historians will see the internet as an event comparable to the development of movable type in importance because of the way it revolutionized human communication. So I wrote that a while ago, and I was thinking it over as I was putting together my actual presentation today, and I realized I was wrong, and that's not correct. And actually, I think that the internet is even far more radical than the invention of the printing press and movable type in some ways, and it's really important to understand this. I have some technical people here from the Internet Society and people in the Libertarian Party who are perhaps less technical, so I'm going to try to briefly explain a couple of very radical, mind-boggling concepts here quickly to you, and the technical people will go, oh yeah, and the other people will go, I think I want you to repeat that again. So you may have heard, or maybe not, the quote from a famous science fiction writer, Arthur C. Clarke, who said that any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. And you might be thinking, well, yes, if an Aboriginal person from a very non-technical society saw an airplane, they might think it was a supernatural creature. But that's not me. But you're wrong. The digital computers and computer networks behave much more like magic than they do old types of technology like steam, internal combustion, hitting a nail with a hammer, turning a screw. With digital computers, computer software, and computer networks, you say something to the computer and it does it. There's no intermediary there. Now, in the physical world, there's a big difference between threatening to kill somebody and doing it. The equivalent with a computer, there is not much of a difference. The digital equivalent to killing somebody might be removing all their personal computer files and blocking them from accessing a computer. What would you do that? You would write a program or actually run a program and send a series of instructions to a machine and it does it. It does it. That's it. So this is really, cyberspace is really a different world and it moves much, much more fast, quickly in every kind of direction, both good and bad, than politicians, public policy makers, legislators can even begin to comprehend. Probably half of Congress would what I just said would be news to them. Cyberspace is evolving again in a very, very, very rapid way. And the way it does it is it's not, you have a blueprint for something and then you build a building. If you're a programmer or even if you're using software, you execute a program, you run a program, and it does it. Reality is being created, at a mind-boggling speed. And so the traditional political systems can't keep up with this. And therefore, this is where there are all kinds of directions things can go, and technology can be used as a force of good or evil, but the Internet Society is working to make the evolution of the Internet a public, open, democratic process. And again, many of what seem like very esoteric technical decisions about allocation of addresses on the Internet or domain names, that type of thing, seem esoteric, but what we were trying to do is explain them in a certain kind of way so that more people can get involved with the decision-making process and it can continue going in an open direction, basically a democratic direction and to encourage the positive evolution of the Internet. More and more people use the Internet, more and more companies, businesses, political institutions use the Internet. Everybody is basically getting online. And there, as a consequence, I like to say, it's like everyone in the world was standing on one street corner. You meet all kinds of people that way. You're going to meet people you like, and you're going to meet some very dangerous, scary people, too. In the same way, there are all kinds of institutions, political and economic forces taking part now in the evolution of the Internet. It used to be that when the Internet was a defense research project or being used by a small number of academics and technical people, that it was a small world. But now there are a lot of different players with different kinds of motivations. And there are a lot of pressures to move the Internet, and what the Internet Society sees is it's a big organization, it's democratic, there are lots of people with different opinions, but what generally would be seen as a negative direction. Currently, the original design of the Internet was very decentralized. The Internet was kind of a neutral channel for communications, and the intelligence was at the end on different people's computers that were communicating over the Internet. So that meant that when you could do something with the software running on your computer that was cool and new, and you would just, through this neutral channel, other people who wanted to do the same cool thing, you could do it. There's been a change there. There are a lot of institutions and political forces to move away from that, what we call the edge-based design of the internet, to something very different. And they include monopolistic business interests who would like to centralize the internet and take that edge-based design away and go back to a centralized computer system where there will be a lot less control by the people who use it. In the same way, there are repressive political institutions that would like to redesign the internet too. In China, for example, they're doing a lot in terms of expanding internet access to the Chinese citizens, but they're not a democratic country with freedom of speech or a lot of respect for human rights. So there in China, they're actually trying to modify the fundamental protocols, the way that the computers communicate over the internet, to facilitate more censorship and surveillance. And they're doing that at the technical level as they build out their fiber networks and everything else. So, and just incidentally, there is an Internet Society of China, but it's a government organization that's not affiliated with the Internet Society and probably does not share our values in too many ways. This is a brief overview of what we're about, there's one other thing I'm just very briefly going to touch on, then I'll open it up and I'll have a beer here.
Sorry.
That's mine, thanks. which is that I know that property rights are very important to the Libertarian Party, and what I'm quite interested in discussing is the ways that what we call property are very, very different in cyberspace than they are in the physical world. If I drink this beer, that means that you can't have it. But if I have an idea, intellectual property, and I tell it to you, and I'm getting old and my memory's failing me, so this is a little shaky here, but then we both have the idea. There's something called the network effect with knowledge and information and communication that's different than physical properties. And so, for example, to go use an example of the network effect, when the first telephone was invented, it was useless. When there were two telephones, it was somewhat useful because two people could communicate at a time. When many, many people had telephones, there was an exponential value increase in the value of telephony because so many people could use that. That's the way things develop on the internet and the way knowledge and ideas also develop and can develop in a positive way on the internet. And so the Internet Society also, this is a separate issue, but is generally supportive and has a close relationship with what's called the open source software community, which is, computer programmers who develop new computer programs in a way that's where the inner workings are made public and can be freely redistributed and enhanced, and as opposed to commercial companies like Microsoft, where you can buy software from them, but you're heavily restricted in what you can do with it. You can't give it to your friends. You're not supposed to. And you don't know how it works. You're not allowed to know how it works or to change its inner workings. So anyway, okay, that's a brief, very brief overview. And what I'd like to do, because I know there's such a mixed audience here, is kind of throw things open and, field some questions here about what we're about and whatever you're interested in. Yeah, you're the,
right, Dave, yes. How did the, because originally the internet, I know Al Gore, of course, and created it, but,
no.
No, but originally the internet was probably created or was probably established by the Pentagon and was being used by the War Department.
Right.
How did it take off? How did it become so popular as something that, 8-year-olds know how to use now?
Right. Well, there were a lot of different directions. Basically, the original, what became the internet was a DARPA project, Defense Advanced Research Project Agency. So that was a R&D part of the military establishment, and they had a problem, which was that they had a lot of computers, but not enough, and also that they were all incompatible with each other, so that you couldn't exchange information. It was very awkward there, and so they wanted to develop a way that they could communicate and kind of bridge some of those incompatibilities between different systems. But it was not a top secret. It was a technical, a research project, and they actively promoted it to the academic community. So in the 70s, there were a number of public conferences where computer scientists from all over the world were invited to come and see how cool the ARPANET was. And a lot of computer scientists from other countries and other you know, more academic types of institutions came and saw that, hey, that computer networks are cool. That's nice. Now, I can't really use this. I'm not allowed to. It's a defense project, and it's really closed. But, you know, I could do that. So they went, you know, back to their various institutions, large corporations, and they designed computer networks. And they were all different and incompatible. But the use of computer networks grew, both in the public and private sectors and in academia. And finally, in the 80s, as they were continuing to grow, and there were more and more initiatives to connect different computer networks. What was finally developed was what was now called the IP, the Internet Protocol, and they're currently using, we'll see one version of it, and then the Internet will be evolving from version 4 to version 6 over a period of time. It is doing that now. But basically, the Internet Protocol allowed these disparate computer networks to work together and communicate and start to communicate them. There were a lot of, in the 90s, as the internet was really beginning to take off, commercial or closed proprietary computer networks that were supposed to blow the internet away and be much better. But oddly, they were more closed, more difficult to use, more expensive, and more inflexible. And they basically, in the open market of services, they were not as attractive. I remember AT&T and Novell were going to, I think, at one point, put together a global computer network and blow the internet away, and it would be kind of closed, expensive, and proprietary. And some people used it, but it didn't take off. Okay, I'm sorry, I've got another question here.
Yes. Today it was announced that Google and AT&T probably are entering into an agreement by which Google will pay AT&T a premium, right, and then Google will have its traffic transmitted over a higher powered line more quickly than anyone else on internet.
Right.
My question is, and that is a question of neutrality and right, equality and all that, but do you have any ideas as to whether there's any laws that are being violated concerning that? What would you suggest as a first look at it?
Was a recent court decision in terms of the FCC's ability to regulate that, and the FCC is now talking about basically there's a way that they can change their area of jurisdiction to expand and include that. Here's the, okay, right. Well, Jolly, do you want to say something about
that? I'd like to address this one. Okay, in terms of Google and Verizon, what they quite made it quite clear today was that there was no deal as such between Google and Verizon like you described. What they have agreed on is on what policy they're going to advise the FCC to conduct with respect to network neutrality. And within that, they did say that they would allow for certain services which might have priority, but they made it quite clear that it wasn't, that it was in terms of like things like medical services and those kinds of things. And so, and where there is controversy about what they did is they said they're for that in terms of wireline. As far as wireless goes, you know, then it's still like the Wild West. But there was the deal that you're describing, there wasn't that deal. That's kind of like, you know, the Times last week was wrong. It's not true.
All right, yeah, I'd like to pick up that subject and discuss it in a much broader way than specifically what we now call net neutrality. For all the access that there exists now to, you know, in urban areas to what's called high-speed internet, quote unquote, the internet, the use of the internet is increasing fast, you know, at a tremendously rapid rate, and there is still a tremendous need for more bandwidth. You know, that's a problem in New York City, and it's even far more severe problem in rural areas of the United States and Canada. Or developing countries.
Could you describe bandwidth briefly?
Yeah, bandwidth is how much data goes through the wire, basically. Yeah, right. How fast your connection is.
Are you aware that last week we slipped through Congress HR, I think 773 designed specifically to control the internet?
to control the internet.
And it may happen that you command to get government information. You should check on it. This was reported, I think, on Campaign for Liberty or one of those sites.
Okay, and it's a one more time, what did this legislation do?
It controls the internet.
Right.
They can stop it.
Oh, okay, I think that what you're thinking of is...
what they call the kill switch.
Oh, right, right, okay, yes.
Something he had the HR,
right, okay, I think I know what you're talking about. Yeah, that is for... there are some serious concerns about what types of authority the federal government might take in case of extreme emergency to protect critical infrastructure that is connected, that you can, of course, uses computer networks, and particularly the internet.
You wanted to talk generally on that.
Right, that's certainly a concern.
I've got an answer on this.
Okay,
one,
sure, go ahead, let's talk about
it. Which, briefly, is that this was to protect essentially infrastructure, and what it was is a law where they can basically disconnect, federal things and the power grids and cut them away from the internet rather than shutting down the entire internet altogether. So again, there's a lot of misunderstanding about what the actual legislation actually says. Okay.
Yes.
Right. Hey, why don't you tell us about net neutrality?
Right. I was going to do that.
Right.
Okay.
I'll
yeah.
Take that one too.
Right. Okay. And I'm going to do this.
All right. Dallin, let him speak.
Right. Right. I want to do that in a particular way that I think that people of a libertarian sensibility will or particularly understand. There is a need for more bandwidth, more connections, faster connections for everyone who uses the internet. And it's, it becomes more of an important part of public discourse, creative endeavor, and essential to every aspect of the economy. This is really, really important. And basically, we have a problem in the United States where certain monopolistic interests have retarded the growth of the fundamental backbone of the infrastructure. So we have a situation where we have legislators talking about restricting the access to a scarce resource, or redistributing it, or controlling who can use what or offer what type of service and how, when what we really need, more bandwidth. Then that's a situation. And there are different kinds of new technologies that can facilitate that. There's questions of physical access to public infrastructure, to existing networks and things like that. And basically, again, there are two choices here. We can have public policies that encourage more building up of this critical infrastructure that we need, or we can say it's scarce, we don't have enough of it, and we're going to say who can have what and how much of it. And so clearly, in my view, is the solution is there's a more rapid implementation or possible, minimal or unregulated access to new technologies, such as what's called the white spaces, which would be a wireless internet medium that uses parts of in between different TV channels radio spectrum that's currently used for TV channels. There's space between those channels that could be allocated for internet use. And the FCC is working on this, but it's taken a long time, and they're dragging their feet with making that available. Different kinds of policies to encourage the actual building out of the fiber optic cable that's the backbone. These are key. Create abundance. Don't restrict and assume that there must be scarcity. Okay, your question.
In short, stop squabbling about how you're dividing the pie and make a bigger one.
You got it. I'll go for that. Okay, right. So stop squabbling about how you're dividing the pie and bake a bigger one, he says. So I'll go with that.
Can I speak on this one?
Yeah,
okay,
sure.
Okay. Hi, and my name is Jolly, and I'm the vice president to the president. And so the history of net neutrality is that the idea was coined by Tim Wu, who's a law professor at Columbia. And the thing which sort of brought him to it is that if you look back in history, you know, say the film industry, when it began, it was an end-to-end business. People made little films and they showed them to their friends. You know, if you look at radio, to begin with, it was an end-to-end industry. People had little radios and they talked to each other until it was Sarnoff integrated it into the broadcast model. Same thing with the film industry. As you know, it became that the Hollywood, you know, they took over the distribution. It became like a vertically integrated. And all these things have started off where people use them to talk to each other, and then they become consolidated and controlled in that way. And so this was, he sees that, you know, the same thing could very well happen to the internet, and you could laugh at it right now. But even now, we're kind of seeing this kind of thing go on within you know, cloud computing. So with net neutrality, the concern was directly that, like, a cable company like Comcast, for instance, would have a problem, you know, with the fact that you were watching YouTube instead of watching their expensive you know, cable channels, and so they'd mess up your YouTube to, like, so that you would still have to keep paying them. And so that's really the concern about, you know, them giving preferential treatment to, like, the stuff that's on their channel that they own as against other people's stuff. When, you know, and because you're getting your internet connection from the same company that's giving you, you know, your entertainment, that's giving you your content. And so, you know, in some other countries, and say in England, they've introduced a thing called structural separation, which says that the people that control the content they give you are not the same people that sell you the pipe, you know. And this is not being accepted in America. But this is, you know, the sort of grounds of the argument between about net neutrality. It's why there's a lot of concern about the NBC Comcast merger, like, right now, because they're at ISP. That's I'll let you talk on.
Sure. Okay. All right. That's a more specific, you know, coverage of some of the current policy issues. Yes. Okay.
I've read for years that South Korea has a much faster system. I read about 30 in order of 10 or 20.
Sure.
Or 30.
That's true.
Is that really true today?
It is true, but here's why.
Okay. Just repeat again.
Yeah. Okay. The question is, he was asking about how South Korea has a very, very fast, high-speed, inexpensive internet service that's superior to what's currently available in the United States. This is true. Why is it true? Well, there are some policy things that they've done differently, and actually, they as I understand it, their government did build out the infrastructure initially, and then made it available to companies to resell at a later point. But the main thing is that, you know, South Korea is a really small country. And so that, I mean, there are some technical challenges there in building the infrastructure, but they're not the same kinds that you have, you know, where you have a really large country and, such as the United States, and some areas in the middle, or, you know, where there's a very low population density, and basically you've got to lay down fiber optic cable a really long distance to connect to a small number of people. So there are some issues there. We had some interesting discussions with the head of a company called Allied Fiber, which is actually building, you know, infrastructure. And what they did is they cut a deal with a major railroad that had already laid down the conduit next to the railroad tracks. So they're going to be putting fiber optic in there and then setting up data centers and leasing access to that. But basically, they were able to cut this deal with the railroads because the railroads have this huge, huge infrastructure, and they're not really in the computer network business. And so they put the pipe in the ground, they were happy to you know, get somebody else to make money off of it. Yes, okay.
A lot of third world countries got better internet service because it's just newer. We have the inertia of old tech, and a lot of companies are not gonna just throw out the old, just get new. So there's gonna be a bit of a lag in the United States while old tech is exploited. until it's considered replaceable.
Right. That is the fact that we have an older.
Can you repeat the question?
Right. Oh, he was just pointing out that there are parts here in the United States where we've had, you know, more sophisticated telecommunications and the internet for a longer period of time. That there is now an old infrastructure there. So, like, for example, older types of fiber optic cables that aren't. Don't transmit as much data, but they're still in heavily in use, and there isn't always a motivation to add, you know, build on top of that if there's something that's working. That's true to a certain extent, but there's such an appetite that there are a lot of companies that would like to get involved with providing better services.
David,
yes, okay, sorry.
I'm concerned about self-defense.
Yes, okay.
As the internet gets bigger, we're all under attack.
Right.
We've been under attack for a long time.
Sure.
We've even got one of the SOBs. And I said, okay, and I kept them on the hook. And I wanted to go nail it, but there was no way to nail it. I mean, this is just a criminal. Basically, it's a highway for criminals, unless we can get them. And if I got one, let's see if we can nail it. There seems to be nothing. I have to go out there and learn. Yeah. I still don't know what to do. Stop these people.
Mm-hmm.
They try to come and get my information.
Right.
I'm
that's
sure
good.
They've got it.
Right.
Today, if something came through, I'm like, how did you get that?
Right.
How would we do it?
Right. This is a complicated question, and there are a couple of issues with this. One is there are a lot of technical solutions there. If your computer was more hardened from a technical software standpoint, so it was harder for someone to break into it, that would be one, you know, there wouldn't be a problem. You know, the crime would not occur. There are a bunch of other issues, and this is something that the Internet Society does try to has initiatives to educate people about. There are a lot of situations now where you engage in transactions, activities on the Internet, and you're not completely aware of ways in which information about you is collected, and that can if, for example, a company. I'll use an example of something that the Libertarian Party will connect with. There was an online magazine for young gay men, and it had things like forums where people could talk and socialize and so forth. And they fell on hard times financially, basically went out of business. They went bankrupt. They didn't have many assets except their subscriber list. This is very sensitive information about young men who are gay and sexually active and socializing with their friends online. This is the one thing that they had, and they were looking to sell it to whoever would pay for it. So that's a kind of issue, that's maybe legal, maybe it's not. It's grossly unethical, and it's really dangerous. And there are a lot of borderline issues there, and what the Internet Society would like to do is educate people more about those types of issues. So that, on one hand, perhaps there are there's legal remediation there, but to make people more aware of some of the issues. And there are a lot of types of services that are more centralized, not really, they're on the internet, but they're not the original decentralized internet model, things like Facebook, where there are, central repositories of large amounts of personal information. And let's say I have an account on Facebook. I have 100 friends who I want to talk to. It doesn't mean that my conversations or my list of friends has to be kept in a centralized place with millions of others where that could be stolen or made available in a way that I don't want. So one of the things that actually some friends of the Internet Society of New York are doing is they're developing an alternative system to Facebook that's very decentralized. So if I have 100 friends on this new system, then I'll have a little database on my computer of my conversations with my 100 friends. Very decentralized, there's less a central point of vulnerability. Another issue with the computer security, it's very technical, is that we have what's not a very heterogeneous ecosystem in terms of computer software. The vast majority of people's personal computers are running Microsoft's one version of Windows or another. Again, Microsoft has a certain business model. They want to make money, and they're kind of, they've always been very sloppy about computer security issues. This is a continuing problem, and you know, tomorrow, if you do your Windows update, you'll be downloading another Windows security fix that will hopefully fix the other problem that was not fixed by the other one. So, you know, if more people use different types of computer software, there would be less of a single type of target where a malicious hacker could write one program and just hammer that on the internet and, you know, hit, you know, a million people, you know, in minutes. If there's more diversity in the software ecosystem and more different ways of doing things that met, you know, the standards of communicating on the internet, that would be a big improvement. Additionally, again, Microsoft's business model is everything about the way their software actually works is a trade secret. It's not subject to public review by anybody else. And so therefore, what we call open source software, where the inner workings are a subject of public review, like academic peer review, you know, for other programmers can look at that and say, that doesn't work. That's dangerous. Let's fix it. Where you can get more eyes on the technical problems, that also is an important security measure. Things happen in cyberspace very fast. It is hard for law enforcement to catch up. And so there have to be, again, it's like magic. We've got to find better spells, better ways to immediately fixing things and making them safer.
It's not acceptable.
Sorry?
It's not acceptable. I waste 20 minutes a day just trying to get rid of the spam.
Sure.
Whatever I gain in efficiency is wiped out that way. Actually, one was a marketing thing about the spammers.
Right.
Because, and they were just so happy. I could reach thousands of people. I don't want them to smash them in the face.
Right. Lots of people would like to do that. Okay, I have another question here. Let me just.
Where does the Internet Society come down on the question of balancing security against handing your rights to somebody else?
This is a very good question. Right.
Where's the average, you know, if you polled your society, right, where would they come down?
Well, there would be a, you know, a wide variety of opinions, but we certainly support. We're very concerned about the rights of, you know, privacy and security and for users, and believe that these things have to be fundamental parts of the infrastructure. You know, the fact is that if I'm suspected of, you know, really seriously suspected of a crime, that the police can go to my internet provider with a warrant and gain a lot of access to things. But for every bad person like me, there are lots of people who need, you know, want privacy and need security. And those things are basically involve making, you know, your communications on the internet private except for who you want it to communicate with. And that's also not only true of individuals, but it's true of government, it's true of, you know, businesses that need to have confidential communication. So the fundamental right to privacy and to freedom of speech is primary, I believe. Yes.
Can I ask you just to explain what the internet model is? You've referred to it a couple
right,
of times.
Right, sure, okay. Yeah, the internet model has a lot to do with, again, that edge-based type of design of the internet. You can correct me, there are a lot of things about what the Internet Society advocates and the internet model, but fundamentally the decentralized design that where the intelligence is at the edges, and where the continuing design evolution, you know, building out the internet as an open public process and the open access for everybody is encouraged. Okay. Yes.
Yeah, David, this is a very interesting presentation.
Sure.
Fascinating. A lot to think and chew on. I have a couple of points I want to ask you.
Yeah.
Number one, you know, open remarks, you said that ISAC is concerned with the public open democratic process.
Right.
As a libertarian, I'm thinking about various governments, including Obama, who wants to give the poor broadband access.
John?
Wi-Fi or that. What do you think of this kind of government interference with the internet?
We're not necessarily opposed to the government having programs to improve access to the internet or build out the infrastructure. There are a number of questions about some of the, for example, the, we're going to have a, in the fall, we'll have a, some companies that are, a couple of that have received, are going to receive stimulus monies, and then another company that does not talk about what they're doing to build out the internet. There are different, policy decisions. You can have something where you subsidize access directly for people who are, perhaps can't afford it, and then there are other ways to go about that where you, encourage abundance, and the cost of high-speed internet access is, cheaper and it's more plentiful.
But then you'll be doing it with taxpayers' money, though.
Right.
That's not right.
Okay. So this is not everybody in the Internet Society is a laissez-faire, free market type of person in terms of their focus, and there would be a variety of opinions on the issue of subsidizing internet access, if that's the question. We don't have a specific policy on that.
The other thing I want to say, but getting back to net neutrality.
Yeah.
I understand that you're using Comcast as an example.
Right.
That by providing in your ISP, let's say that we offer the service that they favor Yahoo Video.
Right.
Okay. You pay for them. Now they say you don't see YouTube, so they'll mess up your connection.
Right.
But you see, the thing that concerns me is Comcast owns the wires and the service. Couldn't they, in the beginning of the service agreement, say, okay, this is what's going to happen? Make everyone understand that this is a policy. If
they were going to
like it, they could go to maybe
buyouts. Right. There was a situation where they specifically, I don't remember the particulars of this, but where Comcast for a period of time did what they call throttle traffic to some type of service. When the word got out about that, the bad publicity was so intense.
Do you have any questions?
Right. Okay, this is a question about net neutrality and the way that some internet providers might have a financial interest in restricting access to certain, websites or services on the internet. Yes, they may, that can happen, and there are problems with it. But historically, he used the example of Comcast. There was a case where Comcast did attempt to, throttle or restrict access or slow down access to a certain service. And the bad publicity that they got was so intense that they backed off from doing it. So there's an example where the market did work, even though we don't have enough choice, in my view, and I think many people in the Internet Society would agree with this, enough choice about options in terms of internet access. There's too much of, theoretically, there's a choice, but in the real world, in many cases, you only have one, where you live, you only have one choice of an internet provider. That's the case where I live. Verizon has fiber optic cable in my neighborhood, but I live in an apartment where the landlord cut a deal with Time Warner, and I'm not allowed, can only have Time Warner. That's maybe technically illegal, actually, in New York State, but
they used to have RCN everywhere.
Yeah, right. So again, if there was more opportunities, more choices for consumers, then that creates a pressure and for better service at a lower cost. And particularly if there's a really egregious situation where Comcast is blocking YouTube because they want you to watch the videos that they charge for, if I can walk away from Comcast and say I'm sorry, I'm going that I've got to see my YouTube, that would hurt them pretty bad, pretty quickly. But it's the cases where there's no choice that you really have a problem. Yes.
What's the latest on the FCC's rulings as exactly what you're saying?
Yeah.
The requirement that I believe the original agreement was that in order to be on the internet as part of the backbone, you had to pass along all packets. That was net neutrality. All packets were passed along no packets could be modified. That is to say, slowed down, sped up, or modified in any way. They had to be passed or not passed. And the question is, what is the latest that the FCC is doing? What's the news?
Let me jump into another, explain something else.
What's the question?
I'm sorry, what?
What was the question?
The question is, what is the situation in terms of current FCC regulation, or basically net neutrality, in terms of the requirement that all network providers pass along all traffic? In the real world, that doesn't happen. Bear with me, I'll explain a couple things. One is that, let's say that I send you an email, and I have ISP 1A and you have ISP B, and you get the email and it looks like we're using the internet. In many, many cases, internet providers, they have their own huge private computer networks, and they will sometimes, very often, do what's called peering, and they may bypass the public internet because it's slow and expensive, and internet provider A directly connects to internet provider B. It's called a peering arrangement. It's very common, it's done a lot. And so basically they're hot wiring, short circuiting your traffic. They're doing what you want them to do better. They're not going on the public internet. So that's something to understand here. Another thing is that in the real world, that there is a lot of traffic that the internet works most of the time, and we take it for granted. It seems to work, but there is a lot of situations, specifically to use the example of spam, where a computer network administrator, because I am one and I do this, I'll tell you, or a internet service provider will, we know this is a source of spam, this is spam, nobody wants it, we're gonna block this IP address and nothing no email is gonna come through there. I administer a mail server at my job, and there, I can configure some basic spam filtering that will just, there are certain kinds of, flags that really immediately, mark something as spam. And so there's a certain rule set that I set up. This is using very standard software. And it says, immediately, there are certain things that are not acceptable on my mail server. I can tell that something's spam. It's got a return address that is fake. That's it, goodbye. That's traffic that's not going through my mail server. So there's a lot of this going on. The question is exactly what is being done, why, and so forth. Is it someone is basically designed?
I'll click on this one.
Yeah, right.
Okay. The very basic nature of the internet is that it's like a bucket brigade. That if we form the internet between ourselves here, it meant if I had a message, I'd rip up my message into like 10 pieces and all these words and write to who it wanted to go to, and then I'd pass it all out and you'd pass it to whoever else, and at the end they'd reassemble it, and that would, and so that's the way the internet works. And the FCC has never regulated that. It is, the very nature of the internet is that it's an entirely kind of like it runs on good faith and people just passing stuff along.
So then the internet is still basically contractually regulated. The contract by which you become a backbone participant is the only.
There is no contract. It just people just do it.
Well, actually, that's supposed to be a contract.
I don't think there's any. There's people.
Are you referring to peering?
When I was under the impression, perhaps I'm wrong. Mm-hmm. That when you signed on as part of the internet backbone, let's say you're a college or a big business or something like that, you use some of your heavy iron to serve as part of the internet backbone. There's advantage to you, and there's duties to you. One of the duties is to pass along each packet you get, along to the what you're supposed to do is essentially take the entire incoming load, pass it along to the next node down the road, and take out what you're needing on the way by.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so your computer is supposed to be smart enough to be looking at these packets and say, one for you, pass, one for you, pass.
A router. You're talking about a router. If you have a router, that's what a router does.
Yes, that's what
And so the way that TCP works is it works on the basis of sort of best efforts, so that You just keep punting the stuff out, and if you get the reply back, it...
When the original contract, though...
There's no contract. You have heard of these contracts.
Well, there are peering agreements.
You know, peering agreements are something else. That's when you say, I'll scratch your back, you scratch mine. Because people pay, you know, people, when your contracts, the only contracts are that, you know, if you're a backbone provider, and I'm, you know, like you pay your ISP to give you bandwidth, the same thing happens as your ISP pays a backbone provider to take their stuff to somewhere else on the internet where it gets passed to someone else. And those backbone providers have the peering agreements, which is, so...
I thought there were limits placed on that. That's the whole point of essentially, when they claimed to have invented the internet, what they did was invent a piece of legislation which put limits on the peering agreements and required them to meet certain minimums between one another.
If Al Gore was here, he would...
Basically, the thing about a peering agreement is basically when two people have so much traffic, right? It makes sense that you want to connect to the bigger internet, right? So you want to connect to other people's networks, right? Because the internet is interconnection of networks. So when you have enough traffic, basically people say, if you carry my traffic, I'll carry yours. And for the most part, it works well because usually people have the same amount of traffic going both ways. But companies also de-peer too. Like if you stop, let's say you don't have any traffic anymore, and you're just using other people's bandwidth, but no one cares about your network, then they'll de-peer. Mm-hmm. So the reason why backbones are backbones is just because they're so big, they have so much traffic, that they can just make an agreement to each other and say, I'm going to send traffic to you, you're going to send traffic to me, and we're not going to charge for it. Mm-hmm. So it's a completely voluntary agreement. Yeah. There's no rules to it. Yeah, it's just two people saying, I want to put stuff on your network, I want to put stuff on mine.
Okay, we're going to go for about 5 more minutes, so why don't people who have not had a chance to talk, this gentleman's spoken quite a bit, okay. So some people here who have not talked yet,
okay.
Fred or this gentleman here.
Okay. All right, yes.
Because of fear of identity theft, I refuse to do any banking, nothing to do with checks, credit cards, IRAs, POs, savings accounts, anything to do with money or finance, or any account numbers for any of the aforementioned on the web for fear of the internet. And because of people like me, I cannot help wondering, has anybody estimated how much business the financial community has lost because of people like me being scared?
It's an interesting question. I'm sure that some studies have been done regarding how much, to what extent people have adapted to electronic banking and those types of services over the internet, and to what extent that they have not. But I'm off the top of my head, I couldn't tell you, point you to a particular study of that sort.
Yeah. I'm sure there are plenty of others me.
Right.
Sir, please.
Okay, Eric, I'm sorry, did you?
Yeah. I just wanted to supplement a couple of things that you've said, a couple of observations. I think just on the IETF, you had mentioned it's a meritocracy, it's very open to people who know what they're doing, but I just wanted to add, it's really open to anybody. You have to know what you're doing to contribute, but if you're just interested, anybody can subscribe to the list.
Sure. Right.
In regards to the, is it a contract, is it not a contract? To the best of my understanding, in addition to the wires and routers, routing hardware and stuff like that, what really makes the internet work is a set of voluntary agreements about how addresses are assigned, how address numbers work, and how packets are routed. Most of the technical decisions about how packets are routed are worked out by the IETF, which David talked about earlier, which is a primarily voluntary organization. It's a meritocracy. It's not even a formal standards body. They have no enforcement power. So what basically makes the whole thing work is that people just agree to do it because everybody else has agreed to do it, which makes the whole thing a bit of a house of cards. People start going off on their own, whether it's a best couple of companies or a government bureaucracy, doesn't matter. basically, if you lose that crowd sense that we all do it because we all do it, there's a real danger that this thing could fall apart. And you wind up with the kind of fragmentation you have in the railroad business before you have standard track cases. But no, there is no, nobody's got a gun in anybody else's head.
But at the same time, that's what's made it so successful, that same time.
Exactly.
Okay. I think we're coming down the home stretch here. I'm sorry. What I'd like to do now is, you know, as a representative of the Internet Society, I'm going to make a sales pitch here. The Internet Society of New York, is a small volunteer, run organization, and we need lots of help. And I think, as I said earlier, I think that there are some ways that our principles align nicely with some of the libertarian ideals. And, he's got just handbills there. Okay. Please join the Internet Society and volunteer and help us. You can join for free. Go to the Internet Society's website, isoc.org, isoc.org. Sign up to be a member a basic member of the Internet Society. Then pick the chapter you want to be associated with. And by the way, please pick New York. And we're going to bribe you, okay, to do this, because if you become a member of the New York chapter of the Internet Society, we will arrange for you to receive a discount on computer books published or distributed by O'Reilly Publishers, which are actually a lot of great computer books on everything having to do with computers, and also their ebook form of that. You get a discount on that too. Okay, we are we have a lot of initiatives here. We do on a regular basis. We have talks, panel discussions, most often at New York University campus, because there's a member of the faculty there on their computer school, the Courant School, who's on our board. And we also have a number of other kinds of initiatives. Merle has a lab and basically a lab to teach people in Harlem, particularly old people and older people lacking computer skills, how to use the internet and how to use computers generally. We have a number of other projects, some software development projects. We have other kinds of programs to help young people who are in graduating computer science schools get involved with high-tech startup companies so that they're doing real creative work as opposed to working on Wall Street. We're hoping to get more involved with policy kinds of issues. We've done a significant amount. Jolly has been working with the New York City Council in terms of some of the policy issues that they're involved with. And we always need more help there. We can do more things if we have more people to help. The Global Internet Society is involved with a lot of internet governance issues, and we would like to be involved with that more, but we need help with people who are just simply interested and can put a little bit of time and learn, even if you're not knowledgeable, if you're interested, learn about it, and then you can start to participate in some of those decision-making processes.
David, thank you very much.